I'm going to say this at the top. I love ballet. I fell in love with it when I was 9. Like anything you love over 30 years, there have been ups and downs. But I want you to know, I'm not here because I want to burn it down. I'm here because I think it needs a bit of a renovation in some areas. It seems ballet is often in the headlines these days as it wrestles itself into the 21st century. Whether it's point shoe manufacturers getting more inclusive with their color ranges, the lack of female choreographers, or a director fired for, well, just do an online search and you'll see some pretty shameful examples. In this Movers, Shakers, Makers miniseries, Ballet for the 21st Century, we're going to talk about three topics that have bubbled to the surface recently. That's not to say people haven't been calling for change before now, but the recent social justice movements have lit a fire under that call for reform. In this miniseries, we'll be investigating each topic, interviewing experts and dancers, and putting forward some constructive suggestions. Today we present Ballet for the 21st Century, Boys Dance Too. Hi, listener. Welcome to the last episode of the miniseries. Like I just said in the series intro, I fell in love with ballet when I was a little girl. And when I began taking classes, it was treated either as something totally normal or even something quite special. And you know, I saw myself reflected in every depiction of ballet I encountered. Quite apart from being on stage, it is the stuff of endless books, movies, lunchboxes, and clothes as a girl. Not so for some of my male colleagues. Speaking to them, I know many of them had a rockier path. But we all did our training years ago. So how has the image of masculinity changed recently in dance, as society has become more open to complex gender expressions? Or has it changed at all? In the wake of hashtag Boys Dance Too, a recent and very public example of a boy bullied on TV for wanting to take ballet, the common defense is that men who dance in tights are really just athletes, capable of lifting women over their heads, that ballet is harder than being a football player. Which translates as, don't worry, there's a manly way of being a ballet dancer. So this argument misses the nuance and spectrum of male dance talent working at the moment. Also, for heaven's sake, why in 2021 are we still having to argue that it's okay for boys to do ballet? In my quest to unpick this subject, I found 5 talented dancers to interview, with a range of experiences and ages. A note, I've roughly stuck to the UK in this episode, as attitudes from country to country vary pretty widely. Okay, so I began by asking my interviewees how old they were and how many other boys there were when they took their first ballet class.
I started ballet when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I was the only boy in the class.
I did when I was 4, obviously local classes, and there was 1 or maybe 2 other boys in my class at that age.
About 6, definitely 6, maybe 7. Yeah, it was a local school. It was the textbook situation. You know, my sister was a student, and I ended up sort of being there. I think there was only one other male student, and he didn't necessarily last for that long.
I started dancing when I was about 17, and there was about 15 girls, maybe, and 3 boys.
I started ballet when I was 9, and I was one of 2, the other boy being my best friend at the time. But it was all a secret.
If you've listened to the first episode of this miniseries, you'll know that I did a survey for classically trained ballet dancers with questions about mental health. In it, I smuggled in a question for this episode. I asked survey takers who identified as male whether they had experienced bullying for their love of ballet. The result? 85% had been bullied. And importantly, there was little or no change between dancers who graduated before 1990 and those who graduated in the last 5 years. Does that surprise you? It didn't surprise Richard Bermange. Richard worked as a classical ballet dancer for over a decade and is now a choreographer and the creative director for English National Ballet's youth company.
No, not at all. There's nothing surprising about that. I mean, part of kind of child behaviour, that when you kind of identify someone being slightly different in some way, then you're kind of ripe for the picking, unfortunately. I mean, it's a terrible thing, but I'm not surprised is my answer. And yes, of course, as a little boy when I was doing ballet, you know, if I would tell my friends at school, you know, you would be ridiculed to a degree. I became very not, I want to say I was fine with it. Of course, I wasn't fine with it, but it became something that I did accept it. And I think it's only now that I'm, you know, older and I'm being more reflective of those, that period, you go, actually, that wasn't great. I wonder how that has affected me, you know, as an adult as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we all have baggage. And I don't think I had a situation that was as horrific as many others.
That's Matthew Palick. He was born in Lancashire and went to one of Britain's most elite schools and danced in one of the big companies. He now teaches ballet and writes about ballet for various publications.
But I definitely didn't fit in. I sort of, one person who has always stayed with me was the music teacher at my primary school. She was incredibly generous and empathetic, and I think she really recognised that I was kind of quite different. I did have friends, but, you know, I mean, I wasn't into, it's so classic, like I wasn't into sports, and that's just kind of what all of the boys did.
Mark Samaras is the youngest person I interviewed for this podcast. He trained at home in Scotland and then in London. He's a freelance dancer now, still performing. Here, he remembers the tension between wanting to do more ballet classes when he was 9 and not wanting other children to find out about it.
And then as it started getting, like, instead of weekends, I was doing Monday nights as well. So that meant I'd have to go to school and go straight to dancing. And I remember having this, like, blue backpack that I had as well as my school bag. And I was just so terrified of taking that into school that I'd like take my coat off and hold my coat and hold my bag under the coat. And then I'd put it in the cloakroom, like under my jacket.
Most of my interviewees who started dancing at a young age found it got more difficult socially when they reached the UK's secondary school age. That's about 11 years old. Richard again.
You don't really have an appreciation for what social structures are, so you don't really get that there would be an issue here. So initially I was quite proud, and I would, you know, I would talk to friends at school, and I think I even brought my ballet shoes in to do a talk about ballet when I was, you know, at primary school. And then I think I realized when I was heading off to secondary school when I was about 11 that I thought, hang on a minute, maybe I need to tone this down a bit. And so I didn't really talk about it at all, which then worked quite negatively against me, unfortunately. And I did have a bit of an incident when I was in my first year of secondary school, where some of the kids decided this was a great opportunity to sort of out me as the ballet dancer. And then that's a pretty, pretty tough thing to kind of get back from.
Mark echoed this transition in attitude around that 11 to 12 year old stage.
I'd say it got worse as I went into middle school. Because that's when kids, when they're that young, don't really care. There's a few. And then as they transition into high school, that's when they start getting a bit more, that's when like the cliques form to pick on the vulnerable ones. It's like that's when it becomes like a food chain at school, especially at school I went
but,
to.
But why would be doing ballet make you or dance in general, like make you the vulnerable one? I mean, is it because they're like absorbing social norms, and that is not a social norm for a man to do?
I think so. And I went to school in Glasgow, like secondary school in Glasgow, where they had like a big football pitch outside the school, and boys played football and rugby, and my dance school was attached, and there was like the group of us. We were like known as the dancers. As you got older, it like kind of dissolved. But for second, third year at secondary school, it was quite apparent that the kids who went just to the secondary school had something against the dancers.
Luckily, not everyone has a horror story. James Forbat had a positive experience as a young boy before he left for ballet school at age 11. He went on to dance for over a decade in one of the top companies in the UK. Here, he reminisces about taking part in an extracurricular pantomime production as a young boy.
And I remember leaving primary school to go and get ready for like the matinee shows. So I got to leave early, and people, sort of other people in the class, saying, "Oh, where are you going? What are you doing?" But it was kind of seen as a bit of a, you know, like a bonus of what I was doing. I would get to leave early and go and perform. I don't remember ever being made fun of.
Look, of course, not all boys are bullied. I'm sure, I hope there are many who aren't. But remember, there were 85% from that survey who said they were. Was there something about James's situation that he thinks may have helped?
As I said, like I really had quite a a good experience in terms of everyone around me being really understanding and supportive. I don't know whether it's because I'm from quite a middle class part of the south of England, where people, it's kind of more normal that someone might go up to London and do ballet classes or be involved in theatre. I don't know.
I should mention that James also had a professional performer in his family. Sometimes that can just help. But does the social construct of class have anything to do with it? I'm aware I'm wading into a tricky topic here, but I think we can all agree that there has long been an elitist problem with the perception of ballet. In Britain, historically, there has been a north-south divide on such things. It's complex. Here's Matthew. He was a young boy from Lancashire in North England, the boy with the understanding music teacher.
No, that's a really valid point. But like you said, it's so complex because, yes, I come from Lancashire, but I also come from a very specific part of Lancashire, which I think in general is probably considered quite middle class. So I don't think that I could even put blame on that. I think if one's having a bigger conversation, 100%. But then, I don't know, you know, then you've got to sort of look at the few examples that we have, you know, and you look at something like Billy Elliot, and that really is about the class system and actually how even that is possible to wrestle with. So I don't think there's no exact fit, is that if there was, then we wouldn't still have these problems. That's the thing.
Ah, Billy Elliot. Since that film came out, there was a supposed Billy Elliot effect, an increase in the number of boys taking up ballet. In fact, the Royal Ballet School reportedly took more boys than girls a few years ago. Do you remember the man in our introduction who said he started dancing at age 17? That was Denzel Bailey. He now teaches ballet in a number of institutions, including open classes in two busy London studios. I asked him if he noticed an increase in the number of boys in class since he started teaching there in 2005. He says he usually gets about
3, 4, 5 boys in class. You're lucky to have 3, 4, 5 boys in class. I don't know. There are, you know, 95% girls in class most of the time, 98% girls in class all the time. I can't say that there's been some sort of, you know, Billy Elliot, so you think, got, you know, talent dancing in class. No, not really. But maybe again, maybe in schools, there's a lot of boys in schools. A lot more boys in schools.
So Denzel also teaches every Saturday morning for a London CAT scheme. CAT, C-A-T, stands for...
which is the Centre of Advanced Training. And there's CAT schemes all over Britain. There's CAT The Place, CAT Laban, CAT Leeds, CAT Manchester, CAT everywhere. These are at school between 11 and 18-year-olds. And there are lots and lots and lots of boys. It's a huge influx of boys at age 11. You know, we start from 11.
That's so great. Excellent. We really want to see more boys taking up dance. But can we link this to a 20-year-old movie? To be fair, Billy Elliot is still a persistent ballet reference. Here's Mark, our young Scottish lad.
It's lovely that people understand, like, that they've seen Billy Elliot, but almost it's 2020 and it's still so... it's not normal enough for just so many men to do ballet that they always refer to that one story. So...
yeah, like 20 years ago.
Yeah, and it's like so many other boys have done ballet since then. When it came out that I was doing dance, it was in my local paper that I was like the Billy Elliot of Troon, of Scotland, and which was lovely. I mean, I was 9, 10, I was in the paper, it was great. But then every single time since then that I've been in the paper for an achievement, it's always been like, oh, the Billy Elliot story. And I think for a lot of boys, actually, I've spoken to a few of my friends about it, and I think they expect, it's like, well, I'm in the paper, I'm probably going to get called Billy Elliot again.
Another important cultural touchstone is Matthew Bourne's Swan Lake, which turned 25 years old in 2020. It famously features men as the corps de ballet of swans, as well as the two traditional romantic leads. It and Billy Elliot are, of course, inexorably linked. In the climax of Billy Elliot, spoiler alert, the grown-up Billy invites his dad to see him perform in that very Swan Lake. It was an important production for so many young boys and continues to be. Here's Mark again, remembering the first time he saw it.
But that piece for me was kind of a turning point in, like, I'd seen Carman, and when I saw Swans, I remember I was watching it at my granny's house, and I remember she just put it on, and it was Swan Lake, and I was, oh, I love Swan Lake, I've seen the classical version. And I remember seeing it, and it was just all these men, and I was like, oh my god, they're the swans, they're all of these men are swans. I was quite young at the time, I don't even think I'd started like vocational training. I was like one of four boys or something, and I just remember seeing like they're like grown men in these feathered trousers being swans, and it was to the like the iconic music, and it was just so, it does, like, I don't know what it is about, well, obviously it's just these men dancing, so for boys to see men like them or like older versions of themselves, it was so captivating, because I think that's when art is so powerful, when people can connect.
Okay, before we go too far down this tidy narrative of the young boy starting ballet against the odds, going on to a professional career, I want to talk about Denzel Bailey's story. Now, boys can start dancing much later than girls and still have a very successful career in a ballet company, as Denzel did.
There was a local guy who lived down the road from me who was dressed like Prince, and he was big, you know, flashy boots and coats and stuff. And people used to say, this guy's a ballet dancer. And then this guy started to advertise that he's teaching in the church hall in Cricklewood near me. So we all, about 10 of us all piled into this class, this jazz class back in the 80s, about 82. And then I loved it. And I sort of picked up everything immediately. You know, all my friends were like, this is nonsense, this is a lot of rubbish. And they all didn't go back. And I went back every week. And that's how I started dancing. Until he said to me, there's a school in Golders Green. If you want to dance, you should do more ballet. And when you went to the school in Golders Green, I mean, there's no boys dancing. So they took anybody that walked in. You want to dance? We'll get you a grant. You can dance. And there was about 15 girls, maybe, and three boys. There was me. There's an Indian guy who worked in Marks and Spencer, and there was a really rough Cockney guy who was a plumber. And the three of us knew absolutely nothing about ballet. It was hilarious fun, and I had a great time. Yeah.
Had you done any like martial arts, or because nothing. It seems quite incredible to me, your nothing body just was.
Yeah, you showed me how to do PK turns, I could do PK turns. You showed me how to chaîne, I could do chaîne. I just picked up everything immediately. I don't know what it was. Step will change, chaîne, step will change, chaîne. And it just seemed so natural. I don't know why.
Because Denzel started late, he seems to have passed that age where kids do the most damaging teasing.
You know, I was already sort of 17-ish, 18-ish. So when I started to go to ballet school and all my friends found out, they were absolutely fine about it. But that was mainly because they had no idea what ballet was. You know, not the fact that I was a dancer. They were like, ballet? What's ballet? What is that? I said, it's dancing. And you showed them an arabesque, you showed them a devil page, and they're like, oh, wow, that's amazing. Just do a little tiny devil page, you know what I mean, to the side. You know, oh, my God, how do you do that? You know, and so nobody really took the piss out of me. Nobody said anything.
Does it surprise him that 85% of boys were bullied in the survey?
It does indeed, because there's so much, the whole world is so dance and performance orientated. When you go and think like Britain's Got Talent, you've got Strictly, there's so much dancing with diversity and all those sort of big dance groups. Dancing is everywhere. I can't believe that people would take the mickey out of somebody because they dance. Because everybody at the end of the day wants to dance. Everybody loves dancing. Everybody wants to dance. But they might make fun of you because you play hockey, or they make fun of you because you like to, you know, do some, you know, because you do judo.
I totally agree with Denzel that dance is everywhere on popular TV, movies, and it's just all over the internet. But if I'm splitting hairs, Strictly is ballroom and Diversity is street dance. Neither are ballet. Is classical ballet somehow less socially acceptable for boys? One common defense against the bullies is that ballet dancers are as athletic as football players. That's soccer for some of you. I think this gets wheeled out a lot because football is something that boys are universally assumed to like. Of course, loads of them do, obviously. The boys section in any clothing store has football stuff all over it. But have you ever seen any images of ballet in the boys section? When you start looking for it, you notice that everywhere, ballet is for girls. Anyway, I happened to pick up one of my son's coloring books the other day, which depicts children doing all of the usual activities. Boys and girls riding bicycles, playing musical instruments. And then I opened to one page and found a pretty stark example of what I'm talking about. Mark describes the pages.
So the girl's in her tutu and her lovely ribbon point shoes going up to her knees. The boy's about to kick a football.
Yeah, and they're on different pages.
Yeah, separate pages. The girl's got a tiara, the boy's in like shorts and a t-shirt. And
obviously, it's the girl who's mm-hmm. going to be the ballet dancer. Why don't they have a boy in his little lycra shorts and ballet shoes?
Yeah. Well, that's something I don't understand. And I don't know whether it's just like when people, like normal people, I say normal people, but people who aren't from the dance industry watch ballet, they always see the girls in the pretty tutus mm-hmm. doing the lovely arabesques and pirouettes and mm-hmm. legs, and the men are always there partnering. I don't know, would you ever see in a colouring book a boy in the middle of like a tour on Lair? I don't know, it's just...
Yeah, I'll put that picture up on our Instagram. As I said in the introduction to this episode, the footballer-athlete comparison is incomplete. Richard explains what he felt was missing from the analogy when he first encountered it in the 1990s.
There was a lot going on in dance also in sort of the late 90s into the 2000s. And I used to recoil because I used to always use this cliche that male dancers are as strong as footballers, which is, it bothers me because it's not the full story. And we appreciate that football players are strong and highly trained athletes. But you know, we're kind of missing the other aspect of what we do, which is the arts. The comparison never really addresses the strength of character of a male dancer and what it requires to be an artist and to be vulnerable on stage and to speak of some artistic truth. So I'd like to hear, on the comparison, I'd like to hear that a male dancer is artistically brave as say a concert pianist or a film director. But that, you know, it's not something that we talk about as a society, that we don't talk about the sort of peeling back the layers of what it is to be an artist. We talk about, it's easy to talk about athleticism and strength and the body, but it's more like tacit knowledge to talk about your artistic strength.
And what's the other one that gets wheeled out? The one about real men lift women.
Yeah, so when I came home and I was so terrified of people making fun of me for doing ballet, my mum's initial response was, well, just tell them that you're around all these pretty girls all day and you get to lift girls in tutus and things. As if that was then to justify the fact that that's why I wanted to dance, because I'd be around all these women rather than the fact mm-hmm. that I love dancing. And that
yeah, absolutely.
The lycra doesn't bother me.
Mark can definitely get away with some lycra. I think we may be getting to the crux of what might be so intimidating or weird for some people when a boy wants to express himself through ballet. The football and the being around pretty girls defense sound an awful lot like code for, don't worry, it's not going to turn him gay. But let's keep going chronologically through a young dancer's trajectory. Let's say now you're in professional ballet school. What's it like there for boys? Well, for one thing, they're probably in an all-boys class for the first time. Richard.
I think it was a really safe environment for me. And there was something quite brilliant about, you've come from a small ballet school in the provinces, and then you've come to London, and suddenly you are surrounded by, I think we had about 10 boys in my year. Suddenly you go, this is right, this is good. These are people that I can identify with. We understand each other. And even though we were quite a diverse group, there was a common thread and there was a common understanding there.
I asked my interviewees about some of the language used in men's classes. Mark says,
because before it was always mixed classes, the men were the minority, and then you move down south and it's all boys. And from the get-go, it does become about like, they need you to be strong, you need strength for like turns and lifts and jumps. And so it's all about strength. There's never any sort of soft, I never really remember saying like, give me light and shade, give me dynamics. There was no... okay, slow, smooth, I don't really remember. I mean, there probably was, but in a boys' class, it was always strength.
I think, obviously, like, the training does become more gender-specific when you get to 16. that sort of age out of necessity.
That's James. He's the one who had such a good experience as a young boy, with no bullying. As he said, boys and girls are separated into different classes in school and will start zeroing in on different areas of their ballet technique. Women are expected to perfect all center work on point, and there's certainly an emphasis on flexibility, adage, port-a-bras. Men are building strength for big, powerful movements, like Mark said, jumps and turns and, yes, lifting women. I am generalizing, I know. Obviously, both sexes are working on overlapping elements, but there is a reason the genders are split into two classes. But back to James. Now, he identifies as a gay man and was out as a student in ballet school too. I bring that up only because it's relevant to his experiences here. He says he, personally, was drawn to some of the more detailed lyrical elements of ballet. Was there any space for that in the men's class?
I guess there would always be talk of sort of, you might look a bit weak or you looked a bit light. I think it could probably be perfected, or like training could go into what sort of language could be used. I never felt that it was like personal, or that I felt upset or offended by the language. I remember being told that I needed to look stronger, that my arms were kind of weak. I remember like being told I dropped my elbows, or that I looked a bit flowery. That's one thing I remember particularly.
So James perceived another divide within his boys' class. I hesitate to call my conversation here nuanced because I'm aware I'm only dealing with gay and straight, and I know there are many shades in between, but just bear with us.
I think more than anything, I would feel that I was actually allowed to be too feminine and to kind of, because I would mess around at the back with the other two gay guys in the class, you know, doing high kicks and split jetés. And which was great fun, and I've always been good at split jetés, so that was useful. And I think a lot of the other, we had a predominantly straight class in school, which is, again, I think more unusual, that it was kind of 80% of the men were and still are straight. There was kind of the group that would do the more macho stuff, or that would be trying out double cabrioles or 540s that, to be honest, just never really interested me. But I was allowed to kind of skip those bits. And of course, that would have been, a complicated conversation to have with students to tell them that you need to focus on these masculine elements because you're going to need them. And when I came to need some of those steps in my professional career, I found that actually I wasn't able to call on them as easily as I would have wanted to. And had I been perhaps made to do them in a kind of supportive environment, that would have meant that I think that was a bit of my training that was missing, really.
Okay, so there are different male and female classes, and definitely male and female steps that you are expected to master in relation to your gender, because at the end of all this training, the top roles in classical ballet, the ones James says you'll need those macho steps under your belt for, are princes and princesses. Here's Richard, who, for balance, maybe I should add, identifies as a straight man.
I mean, ballet is hugely engendered, and that's close because it's old. The structures that are in place within ballet have not really changed over that time. Yes, they've developed, but they've really developed down two very different paths. So you've got steps that are considered female steps that are considered male steps. There is a bit of a crossover in the middle, of course. But even the way in which steps are performed or is different. So obviously ladies dancing on point, men traditionally don't dance on point, although there are some exceptions these days. The way in which you move through the space is completely different. And that can be related to not just male and female, but also in terms of different repertoire and in terms of different time periods when the work comes from.
The way in which you move through space can be female or masculine. I thought that was really interesting. Matthew has a very good example of what might be missing when restricting men and women in terms of pedagogy, or in his argument, young boys and girls.
You know, for example, you will see students in those kind of pre-vocational programs getting to run through the space with like a chiffon scarf. Now, that's a beautiful feeling, and it's a really specific feeling, you know, of space and quality of movement. You know, you don't see male students doing that, I would say. I mean, no, don't get me wrong. Anything I'm saying is not, you know, across all situations and all schools and all teachers. But in general, you would not see a male student be able to kind of move in that way. But actually, when it comes to a narrative ballet and it's about love or and passion and abandon and freedom, you know, I would propose, well, how has that been trained then? Do you know what I mean?
I'm sure I'm not the only one thinking of Romeo running cape aloft towards Juliet and her balcony. Sigh. Now, so far, all our interviewees have had a pretty positive experience in ballet school in terms of bullying. But for Matthew, it was not such a safe space.
Yeah, when I went to full-time vocational school at age 11, I was told that everything would be sort of idyllic, but it wasn't. You know, I had the same problems there, if not kind of almost worse, because, you know, the bullying was sort of was a reaction to the other boys not wanting to be bullied for the original reason, you know, to do with sexuality.
We can all agree that boys being teased by people outside the art form, like the hashtag boys dance to debacle, is a sad but true fact. But as Matthew says, sometimes the bullied become the bullies. In his opinion piece for the Dancing Times entitled "There's an Elephant in the Room and It's Gay," he points out this different and more complex persecution that he experienced as a member of the LGBTQ community. In his piece, he describes an incident.
I was in my third year of training and I was doing an exercise where I really felt that it was capable of expressing myself through that movement. You know, I didn't need to come off exercise, as it were. Like, I was very much in the exercise, but I felt like I could be poetic and individual in the way that I kind of executed it. And then I became aware of my classmates laughing at me and mocking me in a really sort of over-effeminate kind of, you know, I'm using words that they would describe sort of like flowery way. And I saw it and I just became so aware of what was happening. And I really didn't know how to cope. Because I think until then I had felt very safe in the ballet studio. Even though I was working within that very sort of male environment, I was still able to be me because I am male, you know, and I don't have a problem with that. And I don't want to change that. But then it became apparent to me that I didn't fit.
So he ran out of the class and his teacher ran after him, catching by the arm, and said...
He said to me, you know, it's so important that you don't leave because then you're always going to allow that situation to have won. And I was just beside myself, you know, I was so upset. And then he was very, very generous with me. I'd like to think it was all honest. I don't think it was a kind of, you know, teaching tool. How can I deal with this young person? You know, and he said to me, you know, you're different and that's something that you've got to hold on to. That's something that you've got to celebrate. And, you know, it was a really, really very kind pep talk, which was basically allowing me to maybe acknowledge that I was different, but that wasn't a problem. But again, you know, that's one of my ongoing arguments. You know, yes, that's what he said to me, but actually, if you look at the framework, that's not always actually allowed for or executed in the actual situation. So
I think what Matthew's story and his article did very well is muddy the waters around this idea that the professional ballet studio is somehow a haven for boys and men to express themselves. We are getting to a tricky junction here, a junction involving sexuality and gender norms, and a point at which our 21st century awareness of how binary those standards can be starts to cause friction against the classical ballet canon with its princes and princesses. We've already mentioned one production that has challenged those expectations, Matthew Bourne's Swan Lake. You remember Mark sitting in his grand's living room seeing it for the first time on TV? Well, a decade later, he was on stage in those feathery trousers. Here, he remembers performing it on Broadway.
That was the entrance step, you know. Dun, 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 dun. It's a horrible moment. Everyone's dying. They've just come off stage. If you're the first one, you're doing 14 of this. That's this step. But there's that feeling just before you go on, you're like, there's 14 of us on the stage doing it together. And it was that like real camaraderie. But it was that thing of like, we are so blessed to do this. And I came in right at the end. And I think they were all a bit over like, do an step for what, the 267th show, and I was like, guys, come on.
I have stood on the side of the stage like counting in that intro before you get to go on, and it is like being at the top of a roller coaster because you know it's coming, it's the entrance, and it's really like the rest of that act is super super tough and thrilling. Thrilling. I'm so glad you got to experience that.
Best thing I've ever
done. But I resent that you did it on Broadway and I didn't.
Speaking to Mark about waiting in the wings for Act Two, it occurred to me, I've had similar chats before, but never with a man. It was really nice. We all know that many women in ballet feel pressured to be thin. If you want to know what this podcast thinks of that, I refer you to our episodes on mental health and ballet. I'm keen not to make this episode like a competition about who has it harder, men and women. Both sexes face similar and unique pressures, but I think the instances of men and boys being told to lose weight are underreported, and it's not something that's unique to women. James shared a pretty personal story with me on this topic.
I can talk from my own experiences that I suffered kind of disordered eating when I was at school because I wasn't the naturally skinny one, and I was told when I joined when I was 11 that I needed to lose weight. I had been dancing you know, three times a week, and living with family and, you know, nice big portions and whatever. Mm. And suddenly you're dancing every day and it just drops off a little bit. And that wasn't, and I feel like perhaps maybe they should have given me a few weeks to see how people go before you start dealing with it. Like on the first day, like grabbing someone's waist and being like, you need to lose weight. And then I got a nickname of being like the fat one from the boys in my class, which stuck for the whole 8 years. It was really like a joke. It was such a joke, like no one meant it, but it did get me. And then I think just if those things happen to you, like unconsciously or whatever, when you're young, I think it can be really, they get embedded and it can be really hard to undo them. The kind of on the other end of that as a professional dancer, so I was always worried about like, I have to be like as thin as possible in my legs, but I always enjoyed going to the gym and working out, actually as often as lots of gay guys do. And it can be an odd place to be in because I was always trying to like make my upper body bigger and my lower body smaller and be skinny and be and have energy. And I think like you can put a lot of pressure on yourself to be this kind of like perfect specimen.
Told to lose weight at 11? Like, what the actual... This story was a surprise to me. I've known James professionally for about a decade, and you know, you'd never guess. But his wasn't the only such story. Here's Mark.
Yeah, well, that's what I think is the problem, is that everyone just assumes that girls will feel one way about it and boys will feel another way, whereas you have to look at them as a person. Like, do you feel this person is sensitive? Is this person quite happy-go-lucky? Whereas for me, I am a very sensitive person. I have struggled with my weight for the majority of my life. I went to ballet school when I was 12. And from then on, I was like a 12-year-old getting told I needed to lose weight. Looking back on that, I think, how can somebody turn around to a 12-year-old kid and tell them when one, they're already stood in front of a mirror for 4 hours a day in like skin tight clothing and tell them you need to lose weight. Mm-hmm. And then that transitioned. I remember losing loads of weight before my fifth year at secondary school and my ballet teacher.
Can you give the age for that? How old would you be then?
I just turned I was nearly 16. I'd not long been 15, and I was in my fifth year at school, and my ballet teacher came up to me first day back after summer, and she'd seen me with all this. I'd lost loads of weight. She came up to me at the bar and like whispered in my ear, she's like, "I'm so proud of you." Which I think she had the best intentions for me to be like, "Do you know what? That feels nice." But she had no clue how it was lost, or which is like really, it reinforces potentially really negative thoughts. So I took that down to London with me, and my weight when I was at ballet school down there fluctuated quite a lot. And in my third year, I had one teacher tell me in front of the whole class that he was like, "Well, you're just chunky."
In the survey I took, 42% of men said they didn't suffer from eating distress in school. That's everything from restricting calories, negative obsessions about your body, to binging and purging. Compare that with 14% of girls. 14. But when it gets to company life, this evens up, with only 30% of men not suffering. So if there are 30 men in your company, 21 of them may be struggling with some kind of eating distress. But I wrote that survey from a woman's perspective, so I think I missed something specific to men and boys. Richard explains.
I was very skinny. When I started in first year at ballet school, I looked at myself and go, "Bloody hell, I'm so thin." Like, I was really thin, but that was just my natural build. I was just a skinny boy, and I think some of us develop a bit later. And so I realised, okay, I better up this and trying to keep bulky. And it wasn't until my mid-20s that I sort of recognised that I was becoming anxious if I was concerned about not having a good meal. So if I was maybe on tour or travelling for auditions or something, I'd realise that I'm going to struggle to find a good meal tonight, and there would be a degree of anxiety that brought on. And I have friends also, male friends, who were really counting calories, making sure they were keeping the calories up and making sure they were keeping their protein count up as well to get enough intake. And which is not dissimilar. I mean, you know, you see guys, it's kind of a trend, and it might be a bit of an Instagram trend as well. Guys really this kind of male form that is being projected largely on social media at the minute. I mean, it's been there, but now we're really seeing it. This concept of male beauty and keeping those calories up and keeping the protein count up.
That pressure on social media, it's not just on women. In a part of my conversation with Denzel, where we were talking about how much the men's technique had advanced, he brought up an interesting point about social media.
Yeah, I think YouTube has sort of changed everything. I think everybody lives on YouTube and Instagram. And I think people see these stars who we wouldn't normally see. And they all post in these solos. And it's amazing, some of the things that they do. Absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, especially for boys, you know.
Huge. So do you think it's pushed the form
I think so.
I think we've probably both seen girls do perfectly decent double tours and double soda basques. And I think men are getting more flexible as well. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. I think the whole technique is just being pushed more and more and more due to what you see on YouTube and Instagram. I think, you know, and it just shows you the limits that you can push yourself to, you know.
Not that it can represent the entire art form, because an Instagram video has never made me cry, you know, with artistry, right?
Or a TikTok video.
But a TikTok video has, for sure.
I'd like to keep considering the different ways in which masculinity can be expressed in a ballet career. So, let's talk casting. I often say that casting is one of the only barometers by which a dancer can gauge how they're doing. You know, apart from counting pirouettes, there's no score, fastest time, or highest jump recorded to beat. I asked Denzel if there was a, quote, prince type. I'm thinking tall, I'm thinking conventionally handsome, good partner.
Yeah, there are prince types, but I think there are many times when you do get the tall dancer who just can't dance, got no coordination. And tall people have a problem with coordination sometimes. You know, sometimes they just can't beat or they just can't move quickly enough, you know. It's always surprising. We used to have a really lovely Canadian guy, Mr. Paul Chalmers, who was a beautiful dancer, but again, really tall. And he used to do all the beats, the breezes, and all the really quick stuff. And people were always surprised at how fast and clean he was for a tall dancer, you know. Mm. But yeah, you do get those sort of prince types who sometimes are just not good enough. If it's just a pas de deux, maybe they can get away with it. But to do a whole role and the solos and the coda and the à la seconde and the, you know, the ménage and stuff, you know, you sometimes you just can't have that prince type. You just have to go with the smaller, shorter, stockier prince who can actually has the technique to do it.
Of course, ultimately, a man's technical ability matters. But, you know, it's rare that a male dancer who's under 5'6" gets to the very top of the classical repertoire. You have to be like Baryshnikov. Also, if you're a dance lover or a dancer, you'll definitely have witnessed a male dancer who is excelling in a triple bill who's never had a shot at Prince Siegfried. I know women get typecast too, but the prince type thing seems to be a leftover from when men were just expected to hold up the girl and look chivalrous. Anyway, here's James's take on looks and casting.
I think look has a lot to do with casting often. And stage presence. And I think if you're looking at like anything, which is, it's a kind of a masculine, you know, stereotype role, if you look masculine or you dance in a masculine way, that's all going to help towards your casting.
What's a masculine role?
I guess any role where boy falls in love with girl.
So we're back to our princes and princesses. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, they do a pas de deux. Before I get to my next point, I'd invite the listener to think of three superstar male ballet dancers, top principals in big companies. Okay, you got them? I reckon for most of you, they all at least present as straight, which is poignant when you consider how many gay men there are in ballet. This is a sensitive topic, and it may not have occurred to you. It hadn't to me. Which leads me to the question, in terms of masculine types and roles, if you don't fit that mold, if you are at all perceived to have a flowery port-a-bras, so basically if you don't have a heterosexual seeming stage presence, do you need to be told this to get the top roles, to be able to work on it, you know, to get a shot at being at the top of your profession? I'm going to let James answer first, and then Matthew speaks next, with the context of what James had said.
And I think that can happen in a lot of ballet companies where it's busy and there's lots going on and there's lots of people and there's not enough time and you've got 15 productions and the new production waiting in the wings and all of that, that actually like making people feel comfortable to perform in the way that they need to within the kind of parameters of the ballet doesn't necessarily always happen. I think you do need to tell people that they, like, as I said before, need to look masculine on, but I guess the language is the thing which is really important.
Good point.
You know, it's not like saying that you need to look less gay or more straight. It's about looking, you know, stronger or making sure that you're, you know, you're weighted in your legs. But of course, you've got to be careful of not being too wishy-washy with what you're saying so that people don't really understand what you mean. But I think
part, you can talk in terms of character as well.
Yeah, I think it's hard, like, because people aren't used to doing that. It's something that people like need to get used to, or they could be trained in, you know, and have a workshop in. And how do you talk through those things so that people really understand your imagery, but you're not causing offense? But if you have that as a kind of, that's happening alongside changing or evolving rep, which reflects, the people that live in our society now, then that's kind of, I guess that's the best you can hope for, really, isn't it? Because you're not going to suddenly take away all of the rep that people do. So it's going to be a balance of that.
If the ballet world was really to sort of, you know, progress with an authenticity, then that what was discussed is problematic. Because you are basically, you're basically asking an individual to repress their innate, their genuine, I don't know, concept of being into something else. But then we've got to acknowledge that it is a story ballet, you know, and so in that sense, you know, you can look at it like James was saying, that you are, you know, you're taking on a role. It just so happens that that role is asking you to sort of be in denial of your genetic and psychological makeup. I mean, that sounds really heavy, but that is the actual truth. I think this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, again, it's to do with sort of periods in a person's life. When you're an adult, whatever that means, then I think that you have the perspective to make those choices for yourself and to live by those choices. And at any point you can turn around and say, do you know what? I don't want to do this anymore because it doesn't feel right to me. I mean, if we're really honest, when you're in a ballet company, you don't actually have that autonomy anyway, because if you did behave like that, you would just find yourself not on stage, or your contract would just not be renewed. That sounds really, really negative, but I'm afraid that I think that probably is the actual fallout. For a student, it really is way more kind of impactful, because you're being told that you're doing something wrong, and you're being told that your sort of self, there isn't space for yourself, within the work. And then it's kind of, it's so ironic in a way, because it's a contradiction. Because if you have a good teacher, then a good teacher would encourage artistry, whatever that means, you know. And to me, artistry is about expression, and expression is about self-expression. But then when you actually do express yourself, you're being told, no, sorry, that doesn't work. That's basically to you. So that's kind of how I was thinking about that. You know, I was thinking it's so different when you're a professional to when you're a student. But actually all of these things happen to us when we are students. So if you're a good student, you're going to be listening and you're going to take that on board. And even when you are an adult and you have some, you know, perhaps more autonomy, there is this kind of subconscious baggage that you take with you, that there isn't space for that. And if you do that, a certain member of the management that's doing the casting is just not going to cast you.
As I said, Matthew wrote an article entitled "There's an Elephant in the Room and It's Gay." If you've read it, you'll know that he concludes that there is an undercurrent of homophobia in the ballet studio, in ballet culture, and in the ballet rep. So have these biases, he cites, been absorbed from society? Do they come from the outside in? Here's Matthew with a historical perspective. He looks back to the danse d'école, a pedagogy that dates back to Louis XIV.
And that was a really specific period of creation. So in that sense, I think it's inevitable that there was an impact, you know, from the greater world onto what they saw as appropriate and relevant to the Academy of Dance. You know, and that was sort of mid-17th century. And we are now, you know, in 2020, and all the sociological theory that you could apply to the sort of creative period of the danse d'école still exists in the steps the way that they're taught now. So, I mean, that is the mother of all kind of historical baggage, if that makes sense.
There was did you see the Royal Ballet interview with the black dancers? Did you see that at all? It's a really good interview. And it's amazing. I think out of the six of them, I think four of them were inspired by Acosta. Wow. You know, they were all dancing. They were all doing bits and pieces, bit of contemporary, bit of this. They all saw Acosta dancing ballet and was something Swan Lake-y, Spartacus-y. And they said, that's it. I'm only doing ballet from now on. It really hit home for me. We always talk about role models, but that really hit home for me how people just need role models. We've been doing Ballet Black for, you know, 20 years. Cass has been doing Ballet Black, you know. And as, again, you still always hear the comments. It's so nice to see, you know, black ballet dancers or ethnic ballet dancers, which we don't really see when you go to the ballet. But I think a lot of these people wouldn't go to the Opera House to watch a ballet or to go to the Coliseum, you know, to see a ballet. You know, so it's great that they all go to these shows and see that you know what, I'm going to actually go to the Opera House and see a ballet now that I've seen it, you know. And again, it really hit home for me the importance of role models.
Listen to and watch out for is Joseph Sissons in the Royal Ballet, because, you know, there's so much going on in his mind and he's clearly so passionate. And
dancer anyway, but he is not afraid to kind of out the trolls on social media. He's like 100% his authentic self, and that's Harper Waters.
Chris Hampson, who's director of Scottish Ballet, as you know. And I've looked up to him as kind of a bit of a role model of someone that's driven their career in the way they wanted it to be.
Thanks to my interviewees for sharing their role models with us. I don't think it's too corny to say that they themselves are all role models too. There are many intertwining threads of prejudice surrounding boys who want to do ballet. It can be ignorance, it can be ballet's supposed elitism, it can be, you know, just kids picking on kids. But I can't help circling back to whether it's this fear that a boy or a man may be acting like a woman, may be gay, or worse, both. Which is just totally crazy in 2021 that people even care. I asked Denzel what he thought about my theory, and his answer, which was great, actually found a flaw in my question.
Let them dance. Let them do ballet class.
Or just let them be who they're going to be. That's the thing. Let them be who they're going to be, you know, and just support and encourage them. You know, my son could do whatever he wants to do, you know, and I will obviously try. I'll be there for him 100%, no matter what he wants to do, you know, all the time. You know, if he wants to dance, great. If you don't want to dance, great. You know, it's a big deal to me. It's your life.
Denzel's son actually called when our interview was mid-flow.
Let me call you back in about half an hour. Okay, I'm on a podcast now. This is my boy. Yes, I agree.
Did he do ballet? He's
a physio now.
But did he do any ballet?
He never. He did two classes when he was a kid. he did a couple of classes in Ballet Black when he was about 4 years old, and the career was over after that.
So acceptance, not just of what children want to do, but of who they are. What would our other interviewees like to see moving forward from within ballet? James.
When it comes to companies rep, there is so many of these very classical ballets, which are basically museum pieces, which are kind of the bread and butter. That's what you often see written in articles, or you hear people saying, you know, they're the bread and butter of companies, Sleeping Beauty, Swan Lake, Nutcracker, the Tchaikovsky ballets, Giselle, and they're all boy meets girl, you know, boy cheats on girl, whatever it is, whatever happens, they're all along the same kind of line of story. And partly, part of the problem is, I think, people can't see their lives in those pieces anymore. You're looking back into, like, it's like a costume, a period drama, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, totally.
So what I would envisage, I guess, is some of those classical stories which work well, but like turn them on their head a little bit, and maybe it can be two men that are the lead characters, maybe it can be two women, maybe it can be three people that are in a throuple. Like, who's to say that, like, it should be any other way? And I guess if you're having 10 productions in a year that have all got a love story in them, you might find seven of them had a man and a woman. Like, if you're representing diversity kind of, you know, broadly, you wouldn't want them all to suddenly be, you know, gay stories or transgender stories or whatever. But I think some of those stories need to be a bit broader and brought up to date so that people can see, you know, what are we struggling with nowadays? Mental health, body image, technology. And perhaps if some of those were dealt with, that would open up more roles for a more diverse range of people that felt like they could be cast in stuff that suited them, as opposed to always trying to fit into a mold.
Matthew wants more big names in the dance world being vocal about who they are and what they stand for, specifically on social media. But he acknowledges people are entitled to a private life. You know, not everyone will be a James Whiteside. Companies and organizations, however, can't be silent.
As we've said before, hanging a rainbow flag at the front of the building isn't actually enough, or...
Or, I say, like posting a black square on Instagram for Black Lives Matters.
Exactly. Whatever point we have to get across, it does need... it needs representation. And it needs really kind of public representation that will get to every kind of corner of the world. Because that's the only way to educate people. Because then you no longer live on the sort of, you know, the fringes of society. It's no longer obscure. It's no longer out of the ordinary, because it's just there every single day in every possible situation. It's a norm.
I am truly encouraged by what Denzel said about the increase of young boys in schools. I hope that if someone asks those boys to take a survey about bullying in 6 to 7 years' time, far, far fewer than the 85% I found will say they were bullied. I was relaying the coloring book story to a friend just this week, you know, about the boy in his shorts and the girl in the tutu. And I was saying, you know, why can't the little boy be in his ballet gear doing a double tour? And my friend said, yeah, but why couldn't the little boy be in a tutu? What's wrong with that? Or even a little boy kicking a football in a tutu. There's a lot to unpack in this episode. It tackles a relatively new topic. It was new to me, at least. I started by investigating the outside bullying of school-age boys who wanted to take ballet, but I've ended up asking the ballet community to really investigate their feelings and biases about what a man should look like, dance like, and even be like. It can be uncomfortable. Richard and I agree that as a new generation of leaders come in, we'll see new developments.
This is the thing, and some of the younger arts leaders that are coming through now. So people who, you know, who trained maybe 20 years ago and have had careers. I don't know if it's naivety, but there is a general feeling that we can do really good work in terms of helping dancers to feel accepted and also helping to get the best out of people.
I only interviewed 5 men for this episode. I'm sorry if there's a listener who felt they weren't represented. One thing is for sure, there are many, many ways of experiencing being a male ballet dancer. Or should I say, a person who identifies as male. A phrase that only a few years ago I wouldn't have known to use. Society is changing, and ballet needs to keep pace so it doesn't end up, as James said, like a museum piece. That's what I found is at the root of all the topics in this mini-series, the mental health, Orientalism, and this episode on gender. It is that tension between an old art form with established traditions and audiences and the vital, creative artists who inhabit it and want to let new audiences and creatives in. When change comes, it may be too fast for some, but it can feel too slow for others. I think ballet is at a crossroads, but I'm hopeful about the path that we choose for it. Okay, closing credits. This mini-series for Movers Shakers Makers is supported using public funding by the National Lottery through Arts Council England. It has also been a Makeshift Company production. Follow us on Instagram at Makeshift Company and check out our website, makeshiftcompany.com, where there is a link to the podcast website for show notes. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you rate and review the show, it would be most appreciated. Thanks for listening. And now, from the cutting room floor, I give you...
For any of the listeners who don't quite understand what a jockstrap is, it's an apparatus. It's a...